Some economic numbers are abstract,
but some hit you right smack in the wallet.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, April 10th.
Coming up, the market for stolen cell phones.
In New York alone, 7 electronic gizmos are stolen every hour.
Plus Dr. Bernanke's diagnosis.
The banks aren't healthy enough yet. Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Here's a dramatic number. The New York Daily News calculates that in New York, 7 electronic gizmos are stolen every hour. Many of those are expensive cell phones. There's word today the federal government is moving to render those stolen phones a lot less valuable. The plan is to make phone companies maintain a registry of specific phones as opposed to phone numbers. New York Senator Charles Schumer says this will make a stolen phone as worthless as an empty wallet. Ramon Lamas is an analyst at IDC. Good morning, Mr. Lamas.
Good morning, David.
Now, how does this work? Some of the phone carriers, for instance, Verizon, they already have a unique number associated with the phone. They were already tracking, for instance.
Exactly. What they do is that they track every single phone that's on their network so that if suddenly there's some crazy behavior on the phone, they can track that. So if the user suddenly discovers, hey, you know, I don't know where my phone is, it could be used for something else, they can call Verizon and say, is anything going on with my phone?
But some of the other phone carriers don't quite do that, especially the networks that use the type of phones in which you have to put the little chip inside, the SIM card.
And that is part of the problem. So, you know, by finding a phone that you could just slide your SIM into, that saves you a ton of money. And so what carriers like AT&T and T-Mobile are doing is trying to find a system not only that protects your SIM card, but also protects that device and says, here, you know, as soon as we find out that this particular model is lost or stolen, we can shut that down immediately.
Well, it's interesting that it took the federal government to wrangle the phone companies to set up this common registry.
This was an outcry from local police departments who get numerous reports saying my cell phone was stolen. There's a lot of money, there's a lot of time, there's a lot of energy involved to make sure that mobile phone theft does not become incredibly rampant.
Well, Ramon Lamas, IDC, thank you very much for this.
Thank you, Dave. Always a pleasure.
Facebook is making its biggest purchase yet as it prepares to go public. The company is buying the photo-sharing app Instagram for $1 billion. Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe joins us now to discuss. Hi, John.
Good morning.
So Facebook is about to spend $1 billion on a company with no revenue. What's this all about?
It's all about pictures and the funky, artsy filters put on those pictures. Instagram is all about sharing photos over smartphones, putting them on social networks like Facebook's or Instagram's own network. And it's incredibly popular, growing so fast, over 30 million users on iPhone alone, and it just moved over to Android phones as well. And yeah, it's free. It's taken the philosophy of get the users now, get the revenue later.
Now, I went to Instagram's website this morning and found that they don't really even have one. They just have a sort of a link to download the app for your smartphone, which makes me wonder how much of this is just about mobile for Facebook.
It is all about mobile. At least this is when Facebook has tried to really get its footing in mobile. This is almost an admission that Facebook hasn't really done very well with mobile so far. It's a website. And Instagram, growing like crazy, people love it. And the question now is whether people will love it now that it's owned by Facebook. It's worth noting that both companies say Instagram will keep its own identity.
And John, finally, how much does this have to do with Facebook going public? This is just about to happen.
Yeah, Facebook needs to show that it has the future of social covered, and that future involves photos and smartphones. This is, you know, when you look at the future of where the web is going, social and photos and mobile.
John Moe of Marketplace Tech Report, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Greece continues to grapple with budget cuts and painful austerity in the face of massive government debt. Today, a strike stopped ferry services to Greek islands just as the country's tourism season starts. Many Greek government agencies are looking for creative ways to alleviate the financial pain. And now the country's police force is offering to rent out its officers and vehicles to the public. The BBC's Athens correspondent Mark Lowen has the story.
$40 will get you your own police officer for an hour. $260, a patrol boat. Greece's public debt is now over $450 billion. The country is suffering its worst recession in modern history. The new scheme could help the police force raise money and stop the taxpayer from footing the bill. Christos Fotopoulos is president of Greece's police workers' union. He says the move is a mixed blessing.
I agree with this because it puts certain things in order, but I also have my reservations. The powerful and wealthy could end up commanding Greece's police system.
The new service is offered by the Greek police force, mainly for those needing extra security. But it can also be used by film companies or special training for security firms. Besides renting a cop or a police boat, if you're feeling flush, there's always a police helicopter, available for an hourly rate of $2,000. In Athens, I'm the BBC's Mark Lowen for Marketplace.
It's been more than 4 years since the giant investment bank Bear Stearns collapsed, and the banking system is still in trouble. That's the word from Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, who said last night that large banks need substantially more capital to ensure a safe financial system. You're probably not going to hear anything like that from the banks themselves when they start reporting their quarterly earnings this week. Bank stocks have been soaring recently, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports from New York.
2012 has been a banner year for big banks. Bank of America stock is up 60%, which means it outperformed Apple. Ken Thomas is a bank consultant and economist.
A lot of the earnings being reported by the big banks are coming not from traditional earnings, but from loan loss reserves.
Loan loss reserves are the money banks stockpiled during the financial crisis to cover all of their bad mortgage loans. Now banks are releasing some of that money.
A loan loss reserve is like a cookie jar. When the economy improves, banks can take money out of the cookie jar, which counts as income.
Bank profits this quarter are more like a sugar high than real income, says NYU economist Lawrence White. He says the actual business of banking isn't as profitable as it used to be.
I just am unsure about how strong the banks are. I still worry that there are lurking losses in mortgages.
White says if the banks aren't careful, they could find that when they really need a cookie, the jar is empty. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, we will get earnings today from Alcoa, the big aluminum maker, and it's going to give us some sense of what to expect this corporate earnings season. Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, is here now to talk about all this. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So we've had some tough economic news in the last week or so with the jobs report and today some evidence of a slowdown in China. Are you expecting a poor earnings season?
Well, it's anticipation. That's why we've had this four-day losing streak here. Corporations have had excellent profit margins, huge cash flow. For the last 4 years, they've been slashing and burning costs, laying off all restructuring, gave them dazzling profits, but now top-line growth counts, not bottom-line. Sales have to grow, and that's going to be much more modest, and Wall Street really sees that. And the whole question is, who's buying our stuff?
And Julie, I mean, the people that have been buying our stuff have been coming largely from emerging markets overseas. A lot of the companies that have done well over the last couple of years have been multinationals. Is that going to change now with more of a focus on the U.S.?
Well, it really is, simply because Europe is in recession again. China, the demand internally is really slowing down for our stuff. Export demand is still there, which is pretty good. That's keeping them from falling off significantly. But everything we were hoping for internally is not going to happen for the time. But our economy is still crawling forward. That's the good news. We're only going to see about 2% growth, but it's still positive growth, and it is in the cards to stay here. But the big problem is Wall Street's reacting to how much jobs data, it was still positive, but the jobs recovery is going to take a long time to recover. You've got 40% of the unemployed now out of work for more than 6 months. And the big realization is that profit margins always drop from the peak. That was in the third quarter of last year to the mean over the time. So earnings estimates are too high, and that's coming down at this point. But it doesn't mean that the bull market isn't intact.
Julie Niemann of Smith Moore & Company.
So, Jeremy, care to hazard a guess on which U.S. state has the lowest tax on cigarettes?
It's got to be something in tobacco country, I would assume. Maybe something in the Carolinas?
Yeah, Virginia, I was thinking, but it turns out to be Missouri. A tax of just 17 cents a pack, and the national average is a buck and a half. But health advocates in Missouri are pushing for a ballot initiative to increase the levy. St. Louis Public Radio's Maria Altman reports.
At the Good Time Smoke Shop, customers can get almost any pack of cigarettes for less than $5, from Marlboros and Camels to an Armenian brand called Tough Guy. Mary Barber is here to get a carton of Marlboro Reds.
Reds or lights?
Reds.
$30.91.
Even if Missouri's tax significantly increases, she doubts she'd give up smoking.
No, because I always said if cigarettes got $2 a pack, I was quitting, and that was 12 years ago. So I'm still smoking, and they're a little over $4 a pack. So I don't think it would change me from smoking.
But the American Lung Association says there is a direct link between taxes on cigarettes and the number of people who smoke.
The lower your tax, the higher your smoking rate is going to be. And we're seeing that play out here in Missouri.
Spokeswoman Michelle Burns says 21% of the state's adult population smoke, the 11th highest rate in the country. And she says that costs big bucks.
The annual health care costs directly related to smoking here in Missouri are $2.13 billion with a B.
Burns says hiking the cigarette tax would generate some much-needed revenue and also cut those health care costs. But Missouri lawmakers are avoiding any tax hike. Rob Mayer is head of the Republican-controlled Senate.
There is philosophically a pretty strong sentiment not to raise any taxes.
Mayer thinks voters have sent a message. He says in the past, Missouri residents voted down ballot initiatives to raise cigarette taxes.
They've all been defeated, and so the taxpayers and the citizens of Missouri basically over the years have said we don't want any more taxes.
This year, there are a lot of ballot initiatives to increase Missouri's cigarette tax. One proposal is backed by several health groups, including the American Lung Association. The tax would be 5 times bigger than the current rate. But a pack of cigarettes in Missouri would still be 55 cents lower than the national average. In St. Louis, I'm Maria Altman for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This Sunday is the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. The ship was built in Belfast in what is now Northern Ireland. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, Belfast is hoping it'll become the center of Titanic tourism.
The first thing you learn from your guide on the bus tour of the Titanic shipyard: Belfast is not to blame for the world's best-known maritime disaster.
We handed our ship over to an English captain, a Scottish navigator, and a Canadian iceberg. The Irish will take the blame for nothing. Thank you very much.
In fact, almost everyone you speak to here is immensely proud of the ill-fated liner, and that includes Susie Miller, whose great-grandfather was a member of the crew and went down with the ship.
Titanic herself was a wonderful piece of engineering, and that's something we should be proud of. And the other industries and commerce that was happening here in Belfast 100 years ago. So it's about looking back to that confidence that we had and trying to be inspired by it.
And unashamedly trying to make money out of the Titanic connection.
Connor, table of two Titanic salmon course just away.
The Rayanne Guesthouse is one of a number of Belfast businesses to adopt a Titanic theme. Connor McClelland is the head chef and owner.
We created a 9-course version of the last meal that was served to the first-class passengers on board the Titanic on April the 14th, the last night.
A somewhat macabre idea, you might think, but the roast pigeon and summer truffles have already attracted hundreds of diners, even at $100 a pop.
The menu is beautiful. It's a naturally beautiful menu. It eats really well and flows really well.
But will Titanic tourism be a recipe for economic success for the whole city? Alan Clark, head of the Northern Ireland Tourism Board, clearly believes so.
That legacy of Titanic and that world brand will carry through for the long term and actually drive sustainable tourism growth here long term.
The UK government thinks so too. It's pumped tens of millions of dollars into a shiny new Titanic visitor attraction here. Among other things, it shows this film of the discovery of the sunken ship. Not for the first time, the hope is that a shipwreck will yield untold riches. In Belfast, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The folks that created Red Lobster for the seafood lover in you have a plan to create the world's largest lobster farm. It's not in Maine. It's going to be in Malaysia. From Washington, Elizabeth Wynne Johnson reports.
The world's appetite for seafood is getting bigger than the ocean's natural capacity to provide. Bill Herzig runs the supply chain for Florida-based Darden Restaurants, the parent company of Red Lobster.
What we see, frankly, is a significant growth in global demand
not unlike what's happened with shrimp, not unlike what's happened with salmon.
So the restaurant company is building an aqua farm in Malaysia capable of churning out some 40 million pounds of lobster each year, mostly to serve the fast-growing demand in Asia. Robin Alden is skeptical of commercial-scale lobster farming. She lives in coastal Maine and heads an organization that represents fishing communities.
In the long run, this could definitely put more downward price pressure on the lobster, and that's what they will be afraid of.
But there will always be a place for those Maine lobsters. That's because the Malaysian farm will grow spiny rock lobsters that don't have those big, luscious claws. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
Hybrid cars seem to target a specific kind of consumer, environmentally conscious and, in theory, loyal. But a new study out seems to refute that assumption. According to a recent Polk study, two-thirds of hybrid buyers in America don't buy another hybrid after their first one.
Here to talk with us is Brad Smith, Director of Loyalty Management Practice at Polk, who conducted this study. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning.
So how'd you figure this out, that hybrid buyers not quite as loyal as you might expect?
Well, we looked at a census of vehicle registration data and looked at owners that owned a hybrid vehicle and returned to market to buy any vehicle in 2011. And what we found were that 35%, only 35% bought another hybrid vehicle.
Why do you think that is?
You know, it's amazing. Given there's more hybrids available in the marketplace, there's more opportunities for owners to be loyal to the hybrid fuel type, yet we're not seeing the repurchase behaviors that go along with more options in the marketplace.
Maybe it's just a family that bought a hybrid car, thought they've done their environmental duty, and then when they go to buy the second car, maybe they don't go for a second hybrid.
Potentially. Hybrid owners tend to be more affluent, so there could be an addition to the household fleet that would justify that. Yet the hybrid loyalty rates from 2008 through 2011 have bounced only between 35 and 40%. And if you take out the popular Toyota Prius vehicle, that number drops substantially down to about 22%.
The household fleet, that's for the 1%, I assume.
Yeah, potentially.
Well, I see that Prius owners do seem to be a little more loyal. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, the Prius has done remarkably well in the segment. Not only does it have a loyal following as a hybrid vehicle, but in the midsize car segment in which it participates, it has had a very loyal owner following and won the Polk Automotive Loyalty Award in the midsize car segment, regardless of fuel type, 4 years.
So tell me, Brad, if you step out of the field of hybrids, what car brand do people show a lot of loyalty to?
Ford is dominating owner loyalty right now and has done a remarkable job improving owner loyalty from 2006 through 2011. Ford's current owner loyalty rate is about 62%, meaning that 62% of Ford owners who return to market to buy another vehicle buy another Ford brand vehicle.
What can the other car makers do to match that, to get their customers to be more loyal?
You know, if you look at Ford as an example, product launch and product cadence is key. When a product is introduced into the marketplace, sales volumes and loyalty rates tend to increase for the particular model. As the product matures, sales volumes and loyalty rates tend to decline. So having a regular product launch cadence and refresh cadence can help a brand retain more owners.
Brad Smith, Director of Loyalty Management Practice at Polk, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it.
So, David, there are already cable news programs called The Situation Room and The War Room, just taking every room that you could possibly have in the highest levels of government. Well, what about the Oval Office?
Sure, why not?
Why not? Well, there's something like that about to happen. Conservative TV host Glenn Beck has apparently built an exact replica of the Oval Office for his show on GBTV. I saw what it looks like on his website. It looks exactly like the Oval Office. He's going to be using the set for weekly speeches about the things he wishes the president would say to the American people. A spokesperson for his channel says the speeches will be, quote, Reagan-esque.
All right. And finally, a couple of inventions pulling in opposite directions this morning. One of them is an app called Dream On that helps you curate your dreams. It plays music and soothing voices when the iPhone, which you're now sleeping with, detects that you've stopped tossing and turning and have entered the dream stage. The other invention is an infernal alarm clock that won't stop blaring even if you unplug it. The alarm, and we're going to need this on this shift, right? The alarm doesn't go off until you punch the date into a touchpad designed to be placed off in the bathroom or kitchen. The 25-year-old engineer in New Jersey who came up with it says he's been flooded with orders.
You know, I set three alarm clocks on this shift, but So far, I've been able to avoid using the third one, but maybe I should buy one of these alarm clocks that makes you
No, and they're kind of cool and retro looking as well. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
On APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.